Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm film critic April Wolf. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that influenced their own work in some weird way that we can figure out. Today, I'm really excited to have writer, director, producer Andy Timoner here. Hi.
Hello.
It's so lovely to have you.
I'm so glad to be here.
And please make yourself as relaxed as possible.
I'm doing just that. I understand we're going to speak for an hour, so I have my feet are up. I'm ready.
Yeah, get ready. And for those of you who are less familiar with Andy's work or just need a reminder, please let me give you an introduction. Andy is a Floridian born in Miami, but she studied film, literature, and theater at Yale University, where she took a bunch of classes where she could only make films as opposed to writing papers. Andy's first film was a documentary called The Nature of the Beast, which dug into the criminal justice system, racism, and the pro-life movement through one heartrending criminal court case. It's a very fascinating movie. She directed a short film and a few films, like TV projects after that, but it is her 2004 documentary Dig! That made waves on the indie circuit, winning her the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance. Dig followed two indie bands, the Brian Jonestown Massacre and the Dandy Warhols, on a journey that would bring art and commerce to collision points. She then directed Join Us, about a cult, correct? Going into a...
Yeah, it was about families who were searching for meaning in their lives and ended up in a destructive church, which I guess there's over 5,000 such organizations that have gone awry in America of all kinds. So
still prescient, I would say. She directed that before returning to Sundance with 2009's documentary We Live in Public, about the work of Josh Harris, an internet visionary and dot-com entrepreneur who was one of the most prominent people to sacrifice his privacy and love for a very public internet life, which also kind of prefigured a lot of the things that we're seeing with internet online life today. We Live in Public also took home the Grand Jury Prize, making her the sole director to do it twice. Both films were acquired by MoMA in New York for their permanent collection. Andy has also directed the film Cool It, about climate change, a TV doc series called Jungle Town, about an experimental sustainable city, as well as numerous music videos for everyone from Paul Westerberg to the Jonas Brothers in Run DMC. This year, however, she's releasing her first scripted feature called Mapplethorpe, a look at the life of photographer Robert Mapplethorpe, from his rise to fame in the 1970s to his untimely death in 1989. Okay, so that's the rundown on Andy. And, maybe people can guess what your movie is going to be. I don't think that they're going to figure it out. The movie that you chose to talk about today is...
Ex Machina.
Ex Machina. Alex Garland's Ex Machina. So why did you choose that?
Oh, it's a lot of what I'm looking at and studying at the moment, and have been for many, many years, ever since making We Live in Public, which started in 1999. And mm-hmm. I went down the rabbit hole at that point of looking at, the effect of technology on our lives, on our hearts, mm-hmm. and on how we conduct ourselves, and whether or not it's going to destroy us or save us has been something that's very interesting to me to look at. And so I'm developing a series right now that's a follow-up to We Live in Public as well. So Ex Machina really played into all of that, as well as I just think it's a beautifully made and constructed film. Mm-hmm. But I should say that Mapplethorpe stars Matt Smith, who also, was Doctor Who back at the time that I cast him. And that also kind of is an interesting sort of twist, because it's of the sci-fi, mm-hmm. Futuristic show, and I saw no relationship between him and Robert Mapplethorpe from looking at the show itself. It was purely because of my son that I took the meeting. My son, who was 9 and a Doctor Who fan, insisted that I meet Matt Smith, who then I realized when I met him was very much like Robert Mapplethorpe.
But, oh.
Yeah.
It's happy coincidence, yes. I would say. Or just that your kid is prophetic.
might be my next subject.
For those of you who have not seen Ex Machina, today's episode obviously will give you some spoilers, but that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. As always, my motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you want to pause this and watch Ex Machina, this is your chance. And now that you're back, let me introduce Ex Machina with a quick synopsis, just to refresh everyone's memories. Written and directed by Alex Garland for release in 2014, Ex Machina stars Domhnall Gleeson as Caleb, a tech worker who's won a competition to visit his company's reclusive, ingenious CEO, Nathan, played by Oscar Isaac. Nathan's built an AI being that's passed the Turing test called Ava, who is played by Alicia Vikander, and Nathan wants Caleb to judge if Ava is truly human. While Caleb chats with Ava, he grows romantically attracted to her, and Ava appears to reciprocate.
Are you married?
No.
Is your status single?
Yes.
Ava triggers a power outage that turns off the security systems and uses the time to tell Caleb that Nathan is a liar who cannot be trusted.
You're wrong.
Wrong about what?
Nathan.
In what way?
He isn't your friend.
Caleb then grows more disturbed by Nathan's behavior and alcoholism and how he treats his girlfriend Kyoko and also Ava. Nathan says that he intends to kill Ava when he's done with the tests, deleting her personality, which offends Caleb, who's grown pretty close to her. When Nathan is passed out, Caleb steals his security card, alters some of Nathan's codes, and finds security footage that shows Kyoko is AI too. Caleb suspects he too could be AI, so he cuts his arm open to check, and he is human. The next time Ava triggers a power outage, Caleb shares his plan for how they will escape together. Nathan tells Caleb he heard their plans and that this was the real test for Ava's AI to see if she could manipulate Caleb with love, affection, and vulnerability. Caleb then reveals that he knew Nathan was watching and had already altered Nathan's codes.
I figured you were probably watching us during the power cuts. So I already did all those things. When I got you drunk yesterday.
Surprise! Ava escapes. Nathan knocks Caleb out to search out Ava. Kyoko helps Ava stab Nathan, but not before Nathan disables Kyoko and damages Ava. Ava repairs herself with Kyoko and other AI's skin to look like a human woman, and she escapes on the helicopter meant to take Caleb home, leaving Caleb trapped inside the home with no one to help him. Oh, poor Caleb. How did you read this film when you watched it? What was your take on it?
Well, I think it's about a very singular character who's in love with what he can create mm-hmm. over what anyone or anything that comes to him. Mm-hmm. So it's about a visionary who becomes a madman because a combination of just success and isolation and a certain psychosis that develops as a result of being able to manipulate everything around him. Mm-hmm. And so Caleb steps into that world as a guinea pig in that experiment, which you can kind of tell that off the bat. But I believed the connection between Ava and Caleb also. Mm-hmm. And so I found that was really well done. I liked Ava. I thought she did a great job playing Ava. I mean, I think the casting was fantastic for this film.
Yeah.
I think it's really well made because everything about it is believable in mm-hmm. some degree.
Yeah, every potential way that you could read it seems that it could be true. Or in a sense, is Ava just playing a game of chess? Is she only manipulating? Or does she actually have some kind of feelings for Caleb?
She certainly spared his life at the end.
Yes.
But then kind of didn't.
Yes.
Kind of left him trapped there with the other loser humans, Actually, no one else. Really.
No one. Just him
on this island
alone.
She just needed to get going on her own.
Yeah.
I think it's really at the end of the day looking at, our vulnerability as humans in the face of technology when AI outsmarts us, which is within the next, 6 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So likely within the next 6 to 10 years, it already has on some level.
We're being manipulated by bots pretty quickly. So I think that it has.
It already has.
In some senses.
Yeah. But when it's Ava's everywhere. You know, and they're calling the shots. That's like 6 to 10 years from now.
Yeah, and it's scary.
Yeah, Josh Harris, the subject of We Live in Public, tells me not to worry about climate change. Like, don't even worry about that. That's not the problem.
Like, there's something else that's going to be getting
us. He's like, 2026, you're done. So just...
Yeah. Which is a funny thing because Alex Garland, when he talks about this kind of technology, and you can see this later on when he made Annihilation 2, he almost feels a sense of succumbing to what is happening and succumbing to the fact that AI is there, but also attempting, you know, maybe we can make an attempt to try to make AI more kind of like a good type of human, as opposed to just like trying to prevent it from existing at all. Because the way he sees it is that it's like it's going to happen. So
I think that AI is ultimately going to be a reflection of our behavior and our values. And unfortunately, you know, we continually as a society, whether or not, I mean, there's definitely a split. You know, it's basically like Civil War times again. It has been for a decade or more now. It's a very polarized society we live in. There's definitely two sides. And but unfortunately, the side that seems to constantly win with our human nature is the side that is mistrustful as what can I get for me and my family?
Mm-hmm.
Let me grab that first. You know, it's it's that feeling that we don't have enough, and we'll never have enough, as opposed to abundance, you know. And also a certain grabbing at making a mark in our society. Like we need to leave a mark. The idea that we would just, that all of this would just be a blip and that you wouldn't be remembered or that you wouldn't have your 15 likes on Instagram or that, you know, what you did today doesn't matter actually is like unthinkable, right? So like we've fallen into, as Josh Harris says at the beginning, we live in public, like the lions and tigers were kings of the jungle and then they ended up in zoos, you know.
Yeah.
The same is happening to us, but we're herding ourselves into these virtual boxes. We are doing it.
The same thing is literally happening to the characters of Caleb and Nathan within this film as well. I mean, what you're saying with Josh Harris saying that, you know, like the lions and tigers were kings of the jungle, now they're in zoos. Like, that's what ends up happening to these characters, is there is reversal of, you know, like they are the ones roaming free and then Caleb's stuck in a box and he's never going home.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And also the reason why that happens is because of their behavior.
Yes.
Because they make the wrong choices. And that's what we're doing as a society, unfortunately. You know, we're constantly doing that. So I really don't feel hopeful regarding where AI is going to land right now. I think that there is absolutely the opportunity to, and there's a lot of great people working on. In fact, part of my new series is looking at some of those people that are architecting, you know, emotionally sensitive AI, ride along sidekick bots that can help you really stay true to your inner core. But I mean, at the end of the day, disconnecting, unplugging, meditating for hours a day, forming community, groups that really matter, that are aligned with your point of view, getting out of your box. That's all that you can do at this point to try to maintain some sort of autonomy in what's coming. And I don't think that the AI that is going to prevail is going to be the kind that we, that is loving kindness, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because we as a human race are not taking care of one another in the way that we should. And you know, we know this, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's different forms of being human, and being terrible to one another is pretty much the highest human form, it seems like.
It seems like the one that dominates, but there are just so many great people that are forming community. You know, it'll be really interesting to see what happens, actually. I hope I'm around to document some of it because, yeah, there's some really great spiritual leaders that are bringing communities together, that are breaking down boundaries that traditionally existed between religions. You know, my sister is one of them. She's incredible.
I'm curious. This is a movie, and Alex talks about this in interviews and, you know, about, I think, a lot of the films that he writes, the stories that he writes, that he is very comfortable with writing movies that ask more questions than they answer them. And this was one in particular that he felt, you know, that it was asking a lot of questions. And, you know, I can get into some of like the questions that he was posing, which a lot of them had to do with like gender. He was very thoughtful about the ideas of gender and how it's expressed in technology. But how do you feel in general about, you know, the idea of a movie that's going to ask more questions than it will answer?
Well, I'm very much a fan of, I mean, my films are all open-ended, generally uncomfortable. And
you are quite comfortable now, and yet your films are so uncomfortable.
I'm a little bit hot. It's a little steamy in here, I got to say. It's like cold day in L.A., and I'm disrobed. I'm down to...
You're in a tiny box with me.
I am in a tiny box with April. I have no escape.
Yeah. Welcome to your own Ex Machina.
I know, and I herded myself in here, too. I, like, volunteered for this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm going to come in here and do this. Yeah,
sure. I had no idea what I was in for, but... No, I mean, my films are about many, many, many things all at once, generally. Mm-hmm. So, like, on the face of it, Dig is about two bands or about two lead singers. Each wants to be the other one, or each possesses what the other one doesn't have, I should say. And the collision of art and commerce. But it's about friendship and madness and love and, you know, mind control and what we'll sacrifice, again, to have our lives matter and what it is to hold on to your vision and hold fast. So it's like each one or brand. Oh, yeah. Brand didn't even make the bio. Brand, A Second Coming, about Russell Brand.
Oh, yeah.
I made in 2015.
Didn't you do two projects with Russell Brand? Like
I did a short video? Yeah. I did Russell Brand's The Bird, where Russell goes to Twitter headquarters and takes them on.
Okay.
For my, I have this online portal that looks at technology from the perspective of how it can actually empower us and empower democracy and, and all of that. It's called atotaldisruption.com. So I made that film and a film about Amanda Palmer called Amanda Fucking Palmer on the Rocks and another film about Shepard Fairey called Obey the Artist. And those three together are a part of a series called Chief Executive Artist, which is the idea that we kind of have to be we kind of have to balance those two things, that artists have to be entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs should stoke their artistry. And it's kind of looking to bridge that gap. So anyway, long story short, but Brand, A Second Coming also, it's kind of like about, it's about addiction to things outside of ourselves or seeking fulfillment outside of ourselves, at drugs, sex, and fame through the eyes of Russell Brand as he's eschewing all of that and kind of looking inward and taking on bigger topics through his comedy, trying on the shoes of Gandhi and Malcolm X and Che Guevara and Jesus Christ, but simultaneously seeking immortality. So he's trying to make the world a better place, but he's also trying to be remembered forever and all of that in balance. And all that to say that, you know, I remember this woman raising her hand at the London premiere and saying that she felt she changed her opinion of Russell Brand like 19 times during the film. And I thought, I could receive no higher compliment, really, you know, that that was exactly what I hoped would happen. And I feel like that's what Alex is saying, too, is like what we do when we leave gray area is we allow the audience to lean in and grapple with their own issues. You know, with Mapplethorpe, it's the same. It's black and white in such fast succession. It's gray. You know, you're looking at this visionary who took on mainstream culture in general. It was like BDSM, LGBTQ. You're gonna worship this. It's gonna be on the main museum floor. It's gonna be at the Met, you know. And I'm gonna turn the male figure into Rodin and Michelangelo, like gay sex into religious iconography, and flowers into vaginas, and you know, and was this sort of Svengali, and he would not take no for an answer. He just was gonna do that, and so he acted impossibly, and he alienated people, and he framed things up and made them perfect, more perfect, and more perfect, until eventually, like Nathan in Ex Machina, he's alone.
Yes.
With his creations.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will get more into kind of the uncertainty of that story. But, you know, I also want to get into questions about gender and more spirituality, and then also the story of the Bluebeard. You know, is this a Bluebeard story or is it something else? And Sympathy for Monsters. So we'll be right back.
Have you ever watched a movie so bad you just needed to talk to somebody about it?
Well, here at the Flophouse, we watch a bad movie and then talk about it.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything. We'll watch it and we'll talk it. We do the hard work.
Featuring the beautiful vocal talents of Dan McCoy,
Stuart Wellington,
and me, America's Rascal, Elliot Kalin.
New episodes every other Saturday at MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts, dude. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Andy Timoner, and we are talking about Ex Machina. Okay, so I have one fun thing. When I was researching this, there's an interview where Alex Garland was asked a question, and he proceeded to answer with more questions. And this was his answer. And it turned out to be, you know, like, what is Ava? And it was just, quote, does she have a gender? Is she a woman? Is it or is it not reasonable to say she? You could, for example, take Ava's mind and move it to another body that Nathan had created that had the outward appearance of being masculine. Ava's body is externally female, but internally it's just her mind. So if you changed it to a masculine body, would Ava then be a he? Some people would say no. Some people would say it's genderless. And some people would say there actually is a gender. And that is exactly the question I'm seeking to ask. Because if you're saying that the body is irrelevant and the mind is all that matters, then are you saying that men and women, for example, have different minds? And what a female consciousness is different from a male, that a female consciousness is different from a male consciousness? In other words, if the body is interchangeable, then what is it that denotes gender? And conversely, if male and female minds are exactly the same in fundamental ways, which seems like a perfectly reasonable thing to say to me, then in that case, maybe Ava is female because she has the external characteristics of a female, and we don't denote gender based on consciousness. This is extremely complex. If I think about who Ava is as a character, and I'm thinking about this idea that, you know, we have this character, Nathan, who is male and like a cis hetero man who is making these AI, and they are all ultra feminine. It's a really interesting bias that we have in this idea of tech in this movie and potentially in real life, too. You know, like, what are we doing with tech? You know, why is this guy the one who's making these AI? Because, you know, I think about all the robots that people talk to in commercials, all the AI that people talk to. And it's usually women who are they are servicing someone else. And, I don't think that's necessarily a coincidence.
What do you mean the AI people are talking to in commercials? Like,
you know,
Echo?
Like, Echo, Alexa, Siri, and most people tend to choose feminine voices to talk to and to order around. And, you know, there's even Super Bowl commercials where tech and AI figured in quite heavily, but they were all kind of, you know, femme voices.
Yeah, it's all this sexual element to it, you know. Certainly for Nathan, they're all like, they're like fuck dolls, you know? They're like, they're sexy, they're all sexy and for his pleasure, you know, all of them. And that I think he couldn't test, like, certainly Ava wouldn't be able to manipulate Caleb if he hadn't. And at one point Caleb asks Nathan, did you design her based on my porn profile? So, you know, and he did. And so, you know, obviously, like, everything that all those doorways that Nathan had opened that Caleb had opened in his psyche about what he finds attractive were all involved in Ava. But I mean, at the end of the day, I think there is a lot of misogyny in the world that is unconscious. There's a lot of bias. There's a lot of really, really deeply ingrained ideas of who women are in our society and who they're supposed to be. And yeah, people would be more comfortable to say, Siri, do this, Siri, do that, because Siri's a woman. You know, there's no mistake there with that.
Yeah.
You know, but it's too bad, but it's something that we're working on now. All of us women are working on, you know, women filmmakers are working on, I think, a lot. And, women in Congress and, you know, women activists and women in the Me Too and Time's Up movements. And I have a talk show called We Talk, which is all about women shaping our culture, that travels around to does events that I host. And that has been really wonderful, bringing women together. So I think there's just it's a shift, but it's going to take a long, long time. And some of it may never shift. Just I don't think that the male mind and the woman's mind are at all the same. I really don't.
And
I have a son who I love very much and I think is so sensitive and so lovely and so intelligent in so many ways. And there's great men. And there's a lot of women, spiritual women that I'm working with right now who have had male mentors, who have had male leaders or men in Buddhism who've taught them great things, you know. It's not to say that they're not every bit as powerful mentally. They're just different. You know, they're wired differently.
Yeah. And that's to me, that's a fascinating thing to think about through AI, because we have this kind of clean slate of, you know, of discussing what gender is, discussing what that kind of identity is.
It's all on a spectrum, though. You know, I mean, I don't mean to say men versus women. It's just, you know, some of us women have more masculine aspects.
Yeah.
And some, I mean, obviously, then there's transgender. I mean, there's everything, you know, that exists. And luckily, in 2019, we're at a time where all of this is out in the open now, much more. There's a long way to go, but it's incredibly progressed over the last, you know, you think about Mapplethorpe passing away in 1989. And
he would be shocked,
yeah,
I think.
The controversy around his show, just showing all of those images together and, you know, museum directors being led away in handcuffs and Corcoran canceling the show and all of that. You know, I mean, it's 30 years ago.
I mean, is it a weird thing, though, like making a movie about Mapplethorpe, who was, you know, a renegade of his time, but now, you know, the culture is kind of caught up to him, and like trying to find a way to make sure that people who are watching this understand exactly how revolutionary he was when he was making work, when he was alive.
I mean, it's important to me that there's some documentary moments in the film that kind of grounded in the history of the time, to realize it was really recent history, that everything that, you know, he took on was not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, you know, his work today is just not as shocking. There's mm-hmm. some work. I mean, look, the bullwhip up his ass, it will never not be shocking, I think, to look at.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of what he managed to do was to get us to see sculpture and to get us to see fine art in that which we deemed obscene back then, mm-hmm. you know? And it really, that wasn't that long ago. So putting Reagan in, or Pac-Man in, or, you know, McEnroe throwing his racket gives us a sense, or like talking, you know, writing into the script about Stonewall and, you know, just understanding the context of the time, putting Martin Luther King speaking at the Whitney, you know, little touchstones of archival that let us know, okay, here's where we are in history. You know, this really happened. This truly happened. This is a true story.
I want to talk about the idea of shooting something, you know, how the idea behind shooting something, or the feeling that you could have on set while you're shooting it, translates into the material that you actually have. Because Alex Garland was talking about that in terms of the tone of his set infecting the film Ex Machina, and that he didn't really even try to create certain tension, that certain tension existed for him and existed in the movie because there was tension on set. He said the actual process of shooting, because we had to shoot this movie in 6 weeks, basically for budgetary reasons, in between takes, there'd be this frenzy of activity, throwing down boards so a dolly could get moved, turning the camera around, no relighting because it was all practical, but that kind of thing. And in a funny way, the tension, the back note of tension, probably relates partly to that actual process of making it. And I've definitely found that on every film I've worked on, the process of making the film obliquely ends up on the screen. Things, whether it's anger or calmness or speed or whatever it is, you can just see it out there on the screen, and it sort of infects everything.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. You know, Mapplethorpe was shot in 19 days.
Mm-hmm.
So
I know the Brits always think that they have it so hard for budgetary reasons, but
I mean, Matt Smith came off The Crown, the poor man. So he was just, you know, shocked. Whatever indie films he'd done in the past, he'd had The Crown in between,
yeah,
you know, 2 years in the loving bosom of a Netflix budget, you know. And he had to lose, you know, over 20 pounds for the part. So to go from Prince Philip, he had to beef up for Prince Philip, and then to come down to Mapplethorpe being skeletal, basically. So we shot the end of the movie first.
Mm-hmm.
So the tone right off the bat is one of isolation, success and isolation going hand in hand, death, imminent death, AIDS, HIV, you know, the death of his entire community, the death of him, his way of life, everything. That we had to do in 3 days right off the bat. And because it was all about locations, and that's what you have to shoot out, the location, and that's it. And what you get, and what you don't, you don't. And so the tension was so high. The love I'm referring to is the love that I fostered with my actors on the side. That is why they didn't walk off set and walk away from the movie because the circumstances were excruciating, mm-hmm. really. And the love I'm talking about also is the love of Robert Mapplethorpe and the love of that character. I can't finish a movie without loving the subject in some way. You know, mm-hmm. it was really hard with Anton, actually, at the end of Dig, because I just could not access that. I couldn't finish the movie. I had to, like, eventually pull out about 40 minutes of some of the darker stuff and put about 20 minutes of, like, why do I find this so important to tell? Why should mm-hmm. you feel empathy for this individual? And build that into the first 20 minutes so that the audience had a tether. Because if I don't have a tether, they're not going to have a tether, mm-hmm. you know? And so as dark as a character gets, and they do get dark in my films often, there's always this way, this channel through which you can feel for him, mm-hmm. you know? So we brought a lot of that love through, but it's always with such tension. And I agree with Alex, like, oh my gosh, the frenzy in between shooting, mm-hmm. you know, but then Matt having to play every color of the rainbow for this part, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes in a single day, mm-hmm. you know? And one day he had to, you know, go to the museum with Matt, with Sam, do the whole Met thing, meet Patty and be in a limo throwing up from eating a hot dog because he's dying of AIDS. Like in one day, because those were where the locations were. Or, mm-hmm. you know, in one location, I remember he had to break up with Patty, break up with Edward. Edward breaks up with him. He goes down to the dungeon. He goes to the magazine. He drops out of school. And we're talking about like five phases of Robert Mapplethorpe's life, like mm-hmm. in a day. You know, parts of those times, because that's what the schedule called for. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of just tension and stress in just getting to the place where Matt can pull that off, even, you yeah. know, and where the actors can, and then forget the fact that, you know, somebody hits their head on a light, or, you know, the location manager's freaking out, or something else didn't arrive on time, and oh, we don't have the backdrop for outside the window. Mm-hmm. Andy, you know what? You're not going to be – you need to take three scenes and, like, pull them off tomorrow. You know, and that's where my documentary skills came in handy, actually, because yeah. I would just be like, okay, we're riding this out. Like, here we go. And just, you know, as an editor, just thinking, okay, what can cut together here? What can cut together?
You yeah, know, and then using – because then you don't have to shoot all of it. You can shoot what you can shoot.
Exactly. I would just figure out, like, okay, I'm going to take this line of dialogue from this scene that we're going to have to scratch this scene. I've started trading with the line producer. I'd be like, I'm going to give you mm-hmm. – I'll give up three scenes if you give me a Steadicam operator tomorrow. I'll scratch that location. I'll cut the location. I just need a Steadicam operator because I can move so much faster with Steadicam. So, yeah, it was like that. It was nuts. It was nuts. And you can feel it on screen. You can feel it. Perfect, because it's Mapplethorpe, so it's,
I know.
You know, there's this tension throughout the whole thing.
You're actually getting into something that I would love to have be my next point, which is kind of like the harmony between departments when you're making a movie. But we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back and talk about that.
Welcome back, and thank you, Dan, for that scathing report. As you know, Max Fun Drive is coming up March 18th to March 29th, which has some folks pretty excited. But as families around the world get ready to celebrate this season of giving, community, and quality podcasts, some are wondering if it's just too much.
Are they, though?
They are. Some people are all for comedy and culture, but with 45 shows offering hundreds of hours of bonus content, plus all the Max Fun meetups taking place around the world, some people think it's too much.
While other people think it sounds totally awesome.
I took my granddaughter to the mall to get her picture taken, and the mall pod fairy was short. And I, you know, I'm just going to say it. I'm sorry, but everyone knows the pod fairy is tall.
Well, I think we should just leave it there. Until next time, here's the news you need to know. Max Fun Drive runs from March 18th through 29th. Be sure to listen to all of your favorite podcasts. I know I will.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm here joined today by Andy Timoner, and we are talking about Ex Machina. Okay, so something that Alex Garland was talking about when he was doing the press tours for this was the idea, you know, I've said he hated saying that it's an Alex Garland film, or it's my film, or these are my departments. He hated that because he was like, I'm just one person in all of this, and he still feels that way. But he was talking about how there's kind of harmony with the people that he's working with. He's like, so two people who never fucking have any communication with each other, like, say, Jock, who's a comic book artist and was very involved in designing Ava, never then has a conversation with Mark Digby, the production designer. The two of them are sort of in separate camps in some respect, and certainly working at different periods of time in the production. But somehow, her form and the aesthetic of the house feel interrelated. So you've got two departments. No one's talking to each other. Everyone's just kind of on their own page, you know, working. But somehow everything seems to be integrated into one another in the design and in the feeling and in the tone. And, you know, I guess I think that that all has to go back to the director and kind of the tone or the conversations that they're having with all of these departments. You know, is that something that you're aware of when you're making a film?
Yeah, it's a little bit like being a conductor.
Yeah.
You know, and it's about everyone feeling when you gather for breakfast in the morning that they're valued,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there's no job that's too small because it really is not.
Yeah.
And I'm with Alex. I mean, it's more so than in a documentary, scripted film is a real collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has to bring their A game every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of pull each other up with just the spirit of things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one person's bad spirit is like a cancer on the set. Really has to go.
Yeah.
Or it explodes.
Yeah.
2 million pieces, so.
But, you know, I think it's
very important. It's like an organism, really, like an organism.
It's also, I mean, like, potentially just trusting some of your collaborators, too, because it's an interesting thing that when Alex talks about making this film, Alex Garland was saying that, you know, he didn't have a tight control over things. For instance, there's a great conversation that he had about the costumes, because people were asking him, you know, like, what did you do for the costumes? And he was like, I don't know. Actually, that was a conversation between my costume designer and the actors. And he was like, the costume designer and the actors, they knew what we wanted. And, you know, we let them kind of decide together, you know, what does this mean? What does this costume mean for you? Because the costume designer had a bunch of conversations with Alex Garland. She read the script. She knew everything about it. And then just kind of went and worked with Alicia Vikander to find, you know, what might be the dress that she would wear in the real world. What would she select, you know?
So I feel, I mean, in terms of what my process was with Tom Broker, who was our extraordinary costume designer on Mapplethorpe, who did, you know, has done House of Cards and
mm-hmm.
did Saturday Night Live for many, many years. He's brilliant, 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 and so dedicated to bringing exactly that period to life. It's a little different when you're talking about Ex Machina and you're talking about imagined characters and a made-up story.
Yeah.
Versus Mapplethorpe, where you're talking about real people and
probably
Mapplethorpe himself. You know, he made jewelry, for mm-hmm. example. Like, that was one of the ways he survived and made money when he was back at the Chelsea Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved doing it. And, you know, what he wore, when he wore, what he adorned himself with was very much part of the story we were telling.
Yeah.
So it's very specific. And we, you know, a friend of mine here, Lisa Rondazzo, a local designer, fashion designer here in town, helped with all of the jewelry creation because we had so little time. And, I mean, Tom invested his own money, I believe, at a certain point, you know, in just making mm-hmm. sure these costumes rocked and certain things that we needed. Like, we needed his leather robe, or we needed, you know, the specific purple jacket that he wore to the Whitney,
mm-hmm.
you know, when he wore to his retrospective when he was on his way out of this mortal world. And so it's just – it was – I definitely was called to the wardrobe cart, you know, quite a bit to look at, okay, well, what do you think, Andy? But before I got there, for sure, it was what the actor's feeling that day with Tom. You know, mm-hmm. what are the options? They need to become that character.
Mm-hmm.
And authenticity is everything, no matter what. I mean, the audience's ability to suspend disbelief, right? That is
mm-hmm.
what we're going for. And it's really, really important when you're talking about a real person and a real story
mm-hmm.
That took place in a particular time and place, like in New York in this time. You have to believe that it's New York in the 70s, and you have to believe that it's Robert Mapplethorpe you're watching. And so it's really, it's really important that Matt feel comfortable in his skin, the skin being the clothing, you know? So yeah, this, that process definitely is a collaboration as well.
I'm curious about, I mean, if we're talking about costuming, I'm also, you know, like this is clearly you have more room when you're doing a fictional character, like you said. But I'm also curious about, you know, the ideas of design, too, because I feel like there's still ways where you can get creative where it's not necessarily just about, you know, conforming to.
Yeah. I mean, like Jonah Markowitz, our production designer, is brilliant. And he and Nancy Schreiber and I, who's a DP, we form sort of a triumvirate, which is what you want to do in pre-pro. And even in just the first few days of pre-production before we even left LA for New York, we sat with books and books and books looking at that time period. Once you get that right, once you understand, okay, we're all on the same page here, the palette for 70s is going to be warm. It's going to look like this. And you can go as far as this range from this kind of blue, this temperature, to this kind of red, you know? And then when I get to the 80s, I really want it to be cold. I want cocaine to have seeped into the culture. You know, Robert himself is more isolated and successful. And with that, people come to him now. So he's not running around. He's in his slippers, his monogram slippers, you know? It's that kind of those choices. But once you do that, then it's like, what can Jonah and his team pick up, you know? What is Amy and her team and props? What can they pick up? And so I show up on set in the morning and it's, you know, Robert's going to do a line of cocaine. According to the script, he's going to offer his brother some coke. And I'm just, I just start looking at what these guys have pulled together for my set, which is like for our set, which is like, you know, there's a crucifix sitting there. And I was like, does that open? And lo and behold, the top comes off. You know, it slides right off. Like, let's put the cocaine in there. Because they're like, do you want the cocaine on this mirror or this thing or that? You know, they come over with like options, options, options while I'm in a script meeting or something. And it's, well, wait, what about that wooden crucifix right there?
I love that because this is, I mean, this is the same kind of idea that Alex Garland was talking about when he was coming up with even just the design for the robot, for the AI, was the fact that he wanted to do something that hadn't been seen before. We've seen cocaine on mirrors, right? We've seen cocaine on mirrors. So how do you do it differently? And then for him, when he was designing Ava, he said, we started trading drawings and chatting and figuring stuff out. And the first images Jock sent were robot images, which would be colored different ways and stuff. And immediately things started falling into place. Initially to do with the way things shouldn't look rather than what they should look like. It was really important that the first time you saw Ava, you didn't immediately think about something else, another movie. You'd discover something like plastic. Chris Cunningham, Bjork, iRobot, no white plastic because that had already been done. Or, I mean, you might have a little bit of white plastic, but not dominant white plastic. And there was a bunch of visual cues that we had to avoid. And eventually, the thing that really cracked it was the mesh, you know, because you can see, like, her robot skin is mesh. And so I think, you know, that's something that you go through for every movie is how can you present this visually in a different way that doesn't remind you too much of a, you know, some other movie or some other iconic thing.
Yeah, well, a big part of our of Mapplethorpe was film. Also, shooting on Super 16, Nancy shot the Super 16, and then I had a Super 8 camera on my director's chair, and I would shoot Super 8 in between with the actors and also on the way to set, picking up New York at that time.
Yeah.
So I think film is actually a character, and it really wouldn't even look or feel the same if it wasn't all shot on film. And then I agree with that. For example, you know, towards the end of Mapplethorpe, very, very end, when you're going to die, what are you thinking about, you know?
Yeah.
What are you thinking about? You think about what you love, you know? In this case, his lovers were present through his photographs as well. I decided to project them on the hospital room walls. So rolling in a couple of projectors and having him come alive and seeing his first visions of afterlife, you know, or his on his passage out, bringing that alive. I'd never seen that before, you know. I could have cut to those images and cut back to him or done any number of things, but for me, it just like in my mind, that felt like, what if one of his favorite images was washing over the tray, the hospital tray, and up the wall and over the flowers, you know, how moving that would be, how beautiful that would be to see, to try it. Let's try it. Let's try it. You know, and you got to have that that spirit of just play.
Yeah.
I think as a filmmaker, and you really want to find collaborators that have that same game, that same like sort of, yeah, their game to just go for it and try things and make mistakes, and some things work and some things don't. But in this, mm-hmm. in this case, in 19 days, things better work. And luckily, well, we didn't have any film that went bad, or you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. we didn't have any major catastrophes. I feel like knocking on wood, like something else could go wrong.
But. Yeah, it's like now all of a sudden.
But I agree. And I think it must be, I'm sure, for Alex studying the entire sci-fi genre and the history of everything that had been ever done about robots, robotics, and AI was very, very important.
I'm curious. Now, Alice Garland talks a lot about something, you know, he calls tonal spikes. And I'm curious about how, you know, you either did or didn't use something like a tonal spike. Because for him, the dance sequence in Ex Machina became his tonal spike. He said, quote, "Never Let Me Go," the film that he wrote, "is a film I like very much, and I'm very proud of it and all that kind of thing. But I also felt it had a kind of like a monotone that bothered me. There weren't enough tonal spikes. In Ex Machina, I was always hoping for ways to be jagged. It's not quite a Zen vibe, and a Zen vibe smothers everything if you're not careful. So I wanted to be disruptive. The other thing about it was it just struck me as a really strange left-field way for one guy to exert a kind of pressure on the other one, while also saying something oddly despairing about the state he must have been in to have spent presumably months finally honing these solitary disco routines between him and a machine." You know, it says so much about character, and it says so much about like who this person is and what he's doing and why he's doing it.
It's incredible, yeah.
But it's also a tonal spike, and it kind of breaks it up.
I think dynamics are extremely important in film and everything. And I actually, when I was a guest DJ on Morning Becomes Eclectic, I don't know, many years ago, mm-hmm. You have to bring in 5 songs. And one of the songs I brought in was Ramble On by Led Zeppelin, because it goes from 0 to 100 and back to 0. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that Led Zeppelin did that I, as a 16-year-old, was influenced by, you know. And I realized I need to carry this into filmmaking. Mm-hmm. This has got to happen. So it's like every one of my films has that kind of roller coaster ride aspect to it, you know. Mm-hmm. And certainly with Mapplethorpe, there are several touchstone moments where you can kind of go, okay, tonal spike, I guess is what you would call it.
Yeah.
What you're calling it. There's several of those where
it's
just kind
of becomes
chaotic.
Because it can't just be like, oh,
chaotic.
He's dead. You know, like, oh, he's dying and it's sad. And like, because that's, it's all heading in one direction in some sense.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a moment, you know, in the hospital, I don't know if you remember this, that is the biggest laugh in the movie is when he's dying.
Yep.
You know, because he gets the flowers are delivered and they're not. I don't know if I even want to say this because the movie's coming out next week. But
yeah, maybe hold off. But there's a laugh at the end.
There's a big laugh that everybody laughs, you know, and it's really this moment where you just kind of you laugh because it's all those things at once. Mm-hmm. It's tragic and it's funny. Mm-hmm. And he's laughing, too. But it's, you know, it's that mix, that moment, that magic moment that happens in cinema where we can all laugh at something that we don't quite know how to deal with, mm-hmm. you know? So that's a tonal spike, for example. And there's a few early on in the film as well. And then there's like a midpoint one, you know, but it's not like I engineer it like that. It's just that I think life is like that. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to walk out of here and get
rhythm,
a tonal spike today.
Like a natural rhythm to the way that a story would be told where, you know, like you might have a comic reprieve at some point in time, or just like a thing that feels innate.
Yeah, or you know, when Robert has the confrontation, you know, walks in on a very, very angry Milton, and they have that huge fight, you know, and he throws the photograph and it breaks, you know. 4 times he knocked that over, but the elevator kept malfunctioning in the loft, you know? And so it kept opening again, and Milton would be there, and we'd have to take it again and take it again. And by the 4th take, he threw that. And, I mean, we were on such a schedule that it might have been 2 takes, you know?
Yeah.
But it got to be 4 because of this elevator malfunction. And that – I must have worn the glass or the frame down, and the thing shattered. Perfect. Absolutely perfect, you know? And he just takes it and he throws it from there, and it's just this sound of just broken glass, and everything will never be the same again. And it's the broken glass of the windows that – separated them from the outside world where they had their perfect little snow globe. And now HIV and AIDS were taking everyone down. And there was no more impervious bubble to be had. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's great when the tonal spike, like what Alex said about the dancing, it also is commenting on Nathan and how long had he been by himself that he's dancing with this robot, and they had these incredible moves that they learned together. It's so funny. You're watching it. It's so funny. So it does two things, right? It allows us to kind of laugh and open up and sit up and wake up and take a sip of our beverage and keep watching, you know? Mm-hmm. And it re-engages us with the material, but it also creates a very powerful commentary on the character. That's what you want to do with a tonal spike.
Well, we're going to wrap up, and I'm so happy that you were able to come here and talk to me about some film and craft. And I wanted to ask you, where can we see Mapplethorpe?
It should be around. It should be in L.A. and New York and Chicago and Washington and Miami. It's opening, I think, in 20 or 30 cities across America. Mm-hmm. It's at Mapplethorpe Movie on Facebook, I think, and on Instagram. It shouldn't be hard to find. Samuel Goldwyn / Mapplethorpe. Mm-hmm. Interloper Film / Mapplethorpe, probably.
Do some Googling. Do some Googling.
Yeah, you know, let your fingers walk in and then get up and walk. Get off the couch and go to the movies because it's all on film. So yeah. It's very beautiful to look at. It's
and
very pretty.
They can probably see some of your older films.
Interloper Films. Yeah, you can check them out online. Usually you can link to them through Interloper Films. In some cases, like I think Brand is on Showtime, you know, they're just scattered about the interweb.
Do some Googling.
Google.
All right,
Google,
thank you.
And if not, hit me up. I'm Andy Timoner on most things. Today I am.
Today you are. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, April.
And thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. If you do, we'll read it on air. We've got one from potentially hanabataki.com saying, I love this podcast. April is so smart and insightful. Blushing. I love the conversations she has with amazing creative women. Listen and subscribe to it. Now, you will not regret it at all. I like that. It's very formal. You will not regret it at all. Blythe025 says, I've been working my way through the backlist of this podcast. I love it so much. Smart women talking about their favorite genre flicks while also digging into the behind-the-scenes nitty-gritty of making things. Makes me so happy. If you want to let us know what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. Please check out our Facebook group. That's Facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
He isn't your friend.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.